exploring how we can transform our communities in the 21st century with the support of St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Me Learning. Welcome. This is the Community Safety Podcast with your host, Jim Nixon.
Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast. Today's guest has been heavily involved in the research of county lines, which is the criminal exploitation of young people who get involved in the drugs trade. This is a really, really important subject for me. It's been in the press. It's a very, very concerning issue. And today's guest will be able to give us a really good insight into how it all works, but more importantly, how we can try and work together as professionals, as the wider community, so that we can try and eradicate this absolutely disgraceful crime in 21st century UK. This is all about the why of the Community Safety Podcast, that we take on board the information and we use it to change communities for the better in the 21st century. Take a listen to a snippet of this week's episode on the Community Safety Podcast.
So County Lines networks have adapted. We had reports that instead of sending young people from major urban cities into these different areas, what they're now doing, the gangs are trying to recruit local children from the local areas to match the demographic of where they're working. We had reports of the use of disguises such as Deliveroo. Some of them were dressing up as essential workers, doctors, nurses, builders. Apparently, if you wear a high vis, you're very, very rarely challenged.
It's now time for the Community Safety Podcast.
Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Nixon. I've been working in the community safety for over 25 years. The podcast will explore how we can transform communities in the 21st century. I'm delighted to introduce my first guest on the Community Safety Podcast, Dr. Grace Robinson. Grace completed her PhD in 2019. Using Merseyside as a case study, her research focused on gangs, child criminal exploitation, and county lines. Grace is the Executive Director of Black Spot Research and Consultancy Limited, a criminal justice consultancy providing expert testimony, commissioned research, and educational workshops. Grace is also employed by the University of Nottingham as a Rights Lab Research Fellow in Modern Slavery, Perpetrators, and Organised Crime, where she's researching the effects of COVID-19 on child criminal exploitation and county lines drug supply. Grace, thank you so much for coming on to the Community Safety Podcast.
I'm honoured. Thank you very much for having me.
No, it's brilliant. We've been sort of talking on and off for a while, and I'm so sort of interested in all the work that you're doing. It's just so exciting to see some of this sort of evolution around county lines, and it's such an important sort of area of community safety. So I'm just delighted that you're our first guest. Just for the listeners, obviously, you know, we're going to have professionals from the community safety sort of setting, but obviously we're going to get listeners that aren't really familiar with the terminology. So I just wondered, just briefly, in a very kind of simplistic form, can you just explain what you see county lines and child criminal exploitation as?
Yeah, of course. In its most simplistic form, county lines is the process of travelling from one location to another to supply drugs or other illicit goods. It's not a new practice. It's been happening for decades. I think the only reason why it's really come into public consciousness recently is because of the increasingly young age of those that are involved in county lines being exploited into drug supply, and also the violence that they're being subjected to as well.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I want to ask you is, you grew up in sort of leafy Cheshire, and I just wanted to know, I was just interested what your motivation was, because this is a really, really, you know, important subject. And I was just really interested to see how you sort of got into this work.
I think really just for me, it was just an acknowledgement of, you know, how lucky I've been and what solid foundations I've had growing up, and the support from parents, and had a good education, and just really the acknowledgement that so many young people haven't had that. I moved away from Cheshire in 2012, it would have been, to start university. Completely narrow-minded, completely naive to everything that happened, and just living in Liverpool, you know, my mind was blown, as I'm sure you can imagine. Just transitioning through education and through different lecturers, through different voluntary roles, I was sort of exposed to these individuals that had come from really, really deprived backgrounds, completely different to myself, and just always had an interest in it, and now just want to be able to use my background and experiences and the platform that I've got to help those without a voice and in them situations.
Yeah, I think it's when I first joined the police service in 1995, I think the mentality back there for me really was just, you know, sort of lock them up, throw away the key sort of thing. But as I've sort of progressed on this sort of community safety journey, just touching up on what you've just said there, you know, when you actually look at some of the young people that get caught up in what we're talking about today, there is a very, very sorry story to tell, isn't there? There's, you know, there's evidence of domestic abuse at a very young age that they've obviously witnessed that. Other sort of deprivation. Would you say that's quite a fair comment in sort of the work that you've done to date?
Yeah, overwhelmingly, you know, those involved in my Merseyside project had all come from deprived backgrounds, mostly been subjected to substance abuse in the home, domestic violence, things that I had only ever seen on the television. You know, not given the same opportunities and chances educationally and in employment, and even coming from really insecure housing as well. So, yeah, overwhelmingly, all of the young people that I've come across are from deprived and poverty-stricken backgrounds.
You did some work for a youth offending team. Was that something else that sort of triggered you to sort of do this type of work? Was that something that kind of motivated you from what you saw there?
Yeah, so I started in the youth offending team in 2014 or 15, I think it was, as a panel member for restorative justice community meetings. So what they are basically is when a child's been sentenced and has received a, you might have to remind me now, Jim, when they have to go to these restorative justice panels, they've received a...
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean, but you're testing me now. Yeah. But I know exactly what you mean.
A certain sentence where they're kept out of prison, but they've got to do a lot in the community. And, you know, most of the young people that were coming in to these panel meetings were there for possession with intent to supply, possession of cannabis. And then just from that, really, I started the research for my master's research, looking at the possession of weapons amongst street gangs in Merseyside. And luckily, because of the voluntary work that I'd done, they gave me access to speak to practitioners in this youth offending team. And then I just carried on accessing that institution and then started speaking to the young people for my PhD research. So it was kind of, I didn't intentionally access the youth offending team for that reason, but it just progressed from, you know, what I was seeing in those panel meetings and, you know, young people coming in with possession with intent to supply and possessing knives and firearms, you know, really young children that when you question it, you know, where are they getting these weapons from? Where are they getting these drugs from? It must be coming from higher up.
And what was your sort of views of the youth offending sort of setup when you were involved? You know, did you feel that there was a lot of work that needs to be done in that area? You know, obviously we've sort of faced austerity. We're probably going to face more austerity now because of COVID. But back then, from your experience, were you seeing sort of stretch teams?
Yeah, yes, definitely. You know, really, really experienced youth workers who just wanted to give all the time and effort to these young people. But often they would say, you know, we can't sit down and have a meeting with this young person. We can't take them out of this institution and show them things beyond the organisation because of the paperwork that they have to do, because there's not enough resources. For example, one of the sort of things that would be put onto a young person's contract would be to go and work in a food bank or to do some voluntary work. And that would have to take place throughout their time with the youth offending team. there weren't the staff to take them to complete that voluntary work, and so they couldn't be signed off by the courts, and so they couldn't finish those sentences. And yeah, it was really sad, really, really sad. The youth workers are up against very difficult situations and just want to do the best, and they can't because of the restrictions and austerity measures that have been placed on them.
Yeah, it's a really, really difficult position. I think that, like you said, Grace, really, you see a lot of great people doing some fantastic work, but you know, there's only so many hours in the day, and these guys are so professional and they want so much for the young person, but they just like you say, they've got their hands tied. And as I say, you know, COVID, I don't think is going to make things any much better. I don't know what the answer is, but there certainly needs to be more funding pumped into it. In terms of your research, Grace, obviously you've done a lot of research around county lines, exploitation. What would you say are the sort of the main sort of findings of your research around that particular subject? You know, what are you seeing?
Well, obviously you've got, as you've alluded to, the demographic of those involved coming from really deprived backgrounds. All of the young people that I spoke to, and that was around 18 young people, had been excluded from mainstream school. Some of them excluded from multiple different educational institutions, and a lot of them in people referral units, which in my opinion are just breeding grounds for further criminality, and there's not that structured work in place. So it was firstly being excluded from school, which was a massive indicator that they would become involved in criminal exploitation. They've got no structured routine. They've got a lot more time on the hands. They haven't got the, they've got no self-worth because they've been told that, and they've felt that through rejection and through exclusion. And then the next major thing for me, the finding was the role of cannabis in young people's involvement in this environment. Every single one of them had got a drug debt. Every single one of them smoked cannabis. It's normalised. It's not normalised just in Merseyside. It's normalised in the whole of the country. Yeah. You know, one third of people report using cannabis regularly. And it's a huge issue. And it's the way in which that young people were being introduced to drug dealers. It was the way in which they were building up drug debts. It for me, is at the heart of criminal exploitation in county lines, is cannabis.
Basically, what you're saying is using it as a bit of a hook, really, to get them sort of, I mean, let's not beat around the bush. You know, I hate it when sort of cannabis is downplayed. I see the hurt and the you know, the harm that it causes. But what you're saying there is basically, you know, cannabis is really at the heart of a lot of this kind of exploitation. It's how they're hooking young people in, and then, you know, like you say, getting a debt, and then they're sort of potentially in a position where they've got to work for that particular dealer because they're in that sort of difficult situation that I presume that they're addicted and they've got to pay off the debt.
Yeah, definitely. That's simplistic form. That's how it works. Give them a little bit of weed, maybe give them an oversupply more than they've asked for on one occasion. A few days later, turn around and say, you know, you've now got a drug debt of £500 or even £100 is a lot for a young person. And it's always increasing. And it's a debt, you know, that never really seems to be paid off.
Yeah. The one thing I wanted to pick up on that you said there, and I totally agree with you, is around school exclusion and your views on pupil referral units. Now, obviously, you know, I've dealt with, in the line of work that I do, I've dealt with a lot of young people that get sort of thrown out of school. And you're absolutely right. They have a lot of time on their hands. Just playing sort of devil's advocate here. I also sort of hear quite regularly the other side of the coin where you have head teachers or deputy or heads of year saying these kids are so disruptive, we exclude them because they, you know, they are sort of affecting the education of the majority. And I'm only playing devil's advocate here, but what would you say to that?
No, I completely agree that it must be a really difficult situation for head teachers and teachers to be in, because like you say, you don't want their behaviour to disrupt the learning of other people and other young children. But I think as well with, you know, the educational system, a lot of schools have turned into academies. a lot of them will acknowledge that there is drug supply, that there is weapon possession within their school, and they just don't want to address it because of the overall picture and the impact that that would have on their statistics or ratings in the table, so to speak. I just think young people aren't understood. There's obviously a lot of undiagnosed mental health disorders that, given the right patients, understanding, you know, teachers that can relate or teachers that actually want to understand why that young person is behaving in the way that they do, I just think if there was more of that, then there would be less exclusions and there would be a more empathetic stance and a more embracing of challenging behaviour. But it's kind of like, I feel like they just want to shun these children and get rid of them because it's easier than to actually address what's causing the behaviour.
Would you agree that all young people want to achieve and, you know, aspire to something?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I think so. And it's like we were saying earlier on in the conversation, you know, when you look back at the history of some of these kids, you know, and I don't want to make excuses for some of the behaviour that they display, because it obviously, you know, it has an impact on victims and we need to be mindful of that. But, you know, when you look at that background, and the other thing that, you know, I was going to ask you was, do you see in your research that some of these kids are not sort of academically sound in terms of, you know, the maths, the English, but surely what you may see with some of these kids is they've got some like real good skills that, you know, they're intelligent people and they can put these skills to use in other areas as well. Have you seen that in sort of some of the research that you've done?
Yes, certainly. I often say this in my presentations and workshops, that these young children are really intelligent. They just aren't academically, aren't cut out for mainstream education, or aren't able to sit and concentrate for 8 hours a day because of what's going on at home, or they haven't come to school with breakfast. You know, I speak to a lot of these kids and they're more intelligent than me, or they're more intelligent than a lot of people I know in academia. It's just that they haven't found an appropriate way of how to channel that intelligence and haven't been given the opportunity to see where that could lead them or what they're actually good at, or, you know, they haven't seen anything past their estates, a lot of them, which is a really sad thing.
I had a situation once when I was in the police, and I had this guy, this young lad, he couldn't have been that old, late teens, and he was representing himself, and he actually cross-examined me in the box, and he was absolutely spot on. You know, the questions that he was asking me, it was like I was standing in front of a barrister. And, you know, I sort of said to one of my colleagues after, I said, you know, that kid's got real sort of intelligence, you know, he needs to put that intelligence into the right channels, because he's a really, really switched on kid. So that's a classic example of what we're talking about here, you know. And I really want to start to sort of explore this in more, you know, more sort of depth as we kind of move forward with this podcast and look at how we can sort of, you know, look at addressing some of these issues. And it's not going to be easy. Grace, what I was going to ask you as well was, we talk obviously about a lot of young people, and I know probably your research more sort of concentrates on sort of 14, 15 and beyond, but what is the youngest you've ever seen a child involved in County Lines?
It would be anecdotal, really. I've never actually come across a young person themselves, but I spent some time in a school in Merseyside when I was at the very initial stages of doing this research, and the head teacher was discussing a seven-year-old that was involved in running drugs, and all that he was receiving was sausage sandwiches. As crazy as that sounds, he'd not been fed, he'd not had any breakfast, no food in the house, absolutely starving, and that was how easy it was to take advantage of this young person. He was just passing drugs to one person on a regular basis, but he was seven.
So, you know, that's just not going to be an isolated story, is it? You know, I appreciate you haven't got the, clear sort of case studies, but, you know, I don't think it takes, you know, Einstein to work out that that's going to be a common scenario across the UK, isn't it, I would think?
No, that won't be isolated at all. It'll be younger than seven, I would say. You know, they've got phones as well, they've got social media, they're a lot more mature than I think I was when I was that age. They're a lot more exposed to this kind of environment as well.
I think that's one of the things that I saw when I was a police officer, that young kids that were on sort of those deprived estates, they were proper switched on. You know, they had that street craft, as I used to call it. You know, they were a lot more mature, some of them above their years, and it was quite interesting to see. And it just backs it up, really, in terms of my thinking when you say that about, you know, kids being 7 years of age and being involved. Looking at county lines and the sort of the way that some of these kids are treated, give me a sort of typical scenario when these kids, obviously, and I'm seeing this, you know, evidence all the time of kids on my patch, you know, ending up miles and miles away from home, go missing for long periods of time. What's a typical kind of day in the life of a young person involved in county lines?
Firstly, they would probably, if they're lucky enough to be established in a house, that might be the house of a vulnerable drug user, which is often the case. If they're lucky enough to be in an actual house and have a roof over their head, they may, they definitely will sleep in the clothes that they've arrived in. They'll probably be there for about 2 to 3 weeks at a time. They'll have to be alert to answer the phone as soon as it rings, and that might be well over 100 times a day that it rings. They'll have phone calls from the customers in which they're supposed to take the drugs to, and they'll have phone calls from the people that they're working for, sort of as a surveillance and control method. In and out of the house all day long, having to arm themselves with weapons sometimes, given the environment that they're working in. Minimal sleep. If they do, they'll be able to sleep on the sofa if they're in a house. And really just very volatile situations. You know, one young person was discussing a scenario where he was basically distributing drugs from a drug user's house. And all of the, you know, the drug using community is quite close knit. They know each other. They'd invite the friends to the property because this young person's got drugs on them. And he'd basically say, I've got to manage all of the drugs. I've got to manage the money that I'm receiving. I've got to make sure that I'm giving the right money back, that I've got the right money, and I'm managing who's coming in and out of the house. And I'm 14-year-old, and there's about 30 people in this house. In a really, really vulnerable situation that, you know, he could be attacked at any point, he could be robbed, you know, all these things. It's just normalized for them. It's not anything extraordinary, which is the extraordinary thing as well. It's, you know, for me and you, that would be stress, that would be anxiety. It's, can't believe you're in that situation, but for them, it's just normal.
And again, what that demonstrates is a person of that age showing incredible amounts of sort of organizational skills and ability, you know, in terms of there has to be a level of intelligence to do that kind of role, isn't there? You know, at the end of the day, you would have to be switched on to do that kind of role within that sort of setup, wouldn't you?
Yeah, massively. They're multitasking, they're weighing things, they're costing things, they're managing people, yeah.
And I think this just shows evidence that, you know, we can direct them in the right way, you know, and channel them in the right direction. These young people could, you know, and will make, you know, themselves decent members of society at the end of the day, you know, because they're young people at the end of the day and they deserve a chance.
Yeah.
How much are they kind of earning, rough? I mean, we talked about debt earlier, and no doubt, you know, some of them are probably working for nothing because they're paying debt off. But if they were sort of, you know, out there working and getting a wage, what would they on average be getting?
Probably about 3 years ago from when I was speaking to the small group of young people that I did, probably about £100-150 every day, if they're lucky, like you say. A lot of them are just being paid in cannabis or they're just working off a debt.
Yeah. And would I be right in saying that a lot of these properties that they're being put up in, are cuckooing situations? And just for members of the audience that don't understand what that means, basically cuckooing situation is where, you know, people take over a vulnerable person's home and usually sell drugs from that particular location. And the idea that the cuckooing sort of terminology comes from the cuckoo that takes over, obviously, other birds' nests. Is that what you're seeing with county lines?
Yeah, mostly. We've come across recently some cases where individuals that have had the homes taken over will be suffering with mental health issues, will be disabled, will what else we come across? Very elderly people who were isolated and just want a little bit of company. In the main, it is vulnerable drug users. It's class A heroin and crack cocaine users who basically, for allowing people to come and supply drugs from their property, are able to have free drugs, which means that they don't have to go to the effort of finding the money for it, and they don't have to go to the effort of maybe stealing or robbing somebody, and it's an easier life for them, a volatile one.
Did you see any evidence in your research in terms of those individuals whose property is being abused, you know, physically or mentally from time to time?
More mental, I would say. Sort of coercive, manipulative, an undertone of constant threats, and just, I think, an unspoken acknowledgement that there's not a lot that they could do about that situation. So while they are met with violence, I think overwhelmingly it is more emotional coercion, really.
Yeah. I think I've in my research with into yourself, obviously you've mentioned in the past where they'll sort of put them on dares or something like that and do games with them and stuff like that, which isn't particularly nice. You know, just to sort of pass the boredom. Is that correct?
So yeah, Jim, what you're alluding to was probably the most surprising and disturbing aspect of the research that I did. You know, in speaking to these young people that had been exploited themselves from where they were living to this new drug market area, being put up in this drug user's home, and then really embraced the role of exploited themselves. So they took advantage of the power dynamic, the fact that they weren't the most subordinate group in the house anymore. You know, they've got a little bit more authority, they've got a little bit more competence because they're not on, you know, class A drugs. And yeah, they were exploiting drug users to complete drug transactions. They were exploiting drug users into doing daring activities, just as a form of entertainment, really, being sexually exploited, being passed around as a trophy. You know, if they've done a good job, so to speak, for the day, then the County Lines perpetrator would then pay a drug user in drugs to complete a sexual act as a form of what's the word I'm looking for? Don't know what the word is. Gratitude, maybe.
I came across one case once when I was working in housing, very, very similar sort of cooking situation, and just to pass the time and have a bit of fun, they actually put this guy in like a, you know, like the dog crates, and they would, like, you know, if he was kind of causing them any problems, you know, they'd stick him in this dog crate for long periods of time, and effectively like torturing him, really. It's just barbaric, really, what you sort of come across from time to time. But that was one of the most sort of harrowing ones that I came across. We've talked a lot about drugs, clearly. You know, drugs is the big sort of driving factor with all this. Cannabis, you know, I'm so glad that you picked up in your research around cannabis and the effects that that has on young people today. I totally agree. I think it's normal. You know, they don't see any wrong in it, but I think there's a lot of harm associated with it. This is a big question, but how do we tackle drugs in the UK and beyond? How do we effectively tackle it from your perspective?
I think firstly we need to legalise cannabis, and I hope I'm onto something when I say that I feel like that might happen in the near future. As I said before, one third of people report using cannabis, so prohibition is simply not working. You know, decriminalising it or legalising it would drive away organised crime. It would encourage young people to access different services instead of sort of getting the drugs off these gangs. And I would also, certainly drug use needs to be a public health issue rather than a criminalisation response. You know, the stigma associated with class A drug use. And just going back to the earlier comment about these young people able to exploit these vulnerable drug users, it was all done through dehumanisation, because these Class A drug users were deemed less human than anybody else. And that's just purely down to stigma. So I think if we had a public health issue to Class A drug use, heroin and crack cocaine, encourage people to access services, really take away the demand for the drugs rather than trying to attack supply all the time, because that's clearly not working.
I worked in drugs for a number of years in the police service, and I was one of those officers that really believed that I could like make a difference and change the whole world. But to be honest, your grace, I couldn't agree with any, you know, everything you said there. I totally agree with. I would be involved in test purchase operations, not as a test purchase officer myself, but I would be setting them up and being actively involved. And it was just ironic that you would like clear an area one day and then the market would be filled again the next day. And I came to a conclusion before I ended my service with the police that you are really fighting the losing battle. And I would sort of go as far to say, and again, I'm going to be a little bit controversial here, to say that actually if you sort of spoke to a lot of chief constables off the record, I think a lot of them would probably say that legalization would be the way forward, because of the impact that has on their resources. And like you say, the public health issue and all the associated sort of problems that drugs cause. So I do think, you know, there's got to be a better way forward. You know, there's got to be a legalization at least of some of the drugs in the next few years. And if you speak to Neil Woods, who you may know, Neil's an ex-colleague of mine. Neil used to be a test purchase officer as well, and he's massively an advocate of what we're talking about as well, because there's got to be another answer.
Yeah, I mean, we've had drug prohibition for years and years. We've been arresting or trying to arrest our way out of the problem for years, and it's not going away. It's not addressing the root causes. It's a waste of resources when those resources could be ploughed into actually helping people. And for what? Arrest figures that make a police force look good or provide a police force with more resources or more finances? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think being sort of on the side of the police, as I am, because I was one for a long time, they do a really good job in terms of, you know, when I was involved, you know, you do put your heart and soul into it. But like I said, you know, and this is only my own personal view, you just come to a point where you admit defeat and you think there has got to be a better way to deal with this. So, you know, I think they're doing what they can, but I think we just need that approach where we do need a radical rethink in how we do things.
They do a really good job. And, you know, the research that I've been doing with the University of Nottingham, we've spoken to so many different police officers, and they, you know, I think it's a general frustration that they're doing an amazing job, but they're always one step behind. The organised criminals always seem to be a step ahead. And like you say, they'll disrupt drug supply for maybe 3 hours when they take a gang out of the market or an organised crime group. So,
you know what, Grace, you know, the amount of money that's spent on an operation like that. When I first got involved in test purchase operations, I couldn't believe the amount of money that was spent on those operations. And, you know, it's great when you do the arrest phase. It's great when you get those people in custody and you put the evidence to them and say, look, you know, you've been supplying to an undercover officer. But as a neighbourhood officer, as I was back then, when you then see that market filled again within a very short period of time, it's absolutely devastating, you know, as an officer and for that community. Yeah. Because the harm is back there in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
What other barriers do you think we sort of face around change in terms of county lines? Is it still what you were saying earlier around sort of that education and that sort of wider sort of approach to how we sort of tackle it, like you were saying about public health approach? Is that how you see sort of things sort of changing as we move forward?
Yeah, I think we need a public health approach to drug use, definitely. That would be probably one of the first things that I would recommend. I think one of the biggest barriers is the biases that we have and the stereotypes that we have about what kind of children can be drawn into this. And I think a lot of the time it's people can just be resigned to thinking about it because they think, oh, it's not going to happen to me, or it's not going to happen to my child because we're from a nice background, or But, you know, it's something that we're seeing quite often now is that young people are being exploited from affluent backgrounds. It's not just a financial issue. Females are being exploited. I think one of the issues that we've got there is that practitioners wouldn't necessarily think that a young female was holding drugs or wasn't involved. So we need to look at the stereotypes that we have and the mindsets that we have. What are the barriers? Intelligence sharing, and that's coming from the research that I've been doing at the minute. And it's really surprised me to find that different police forces have different information sharing systems. And then obviously different local authorities have different information sharing systems. And I think it's a general frustration amongst everyone that we've spoken to in frontline positions that there's just not an easy way of sharing information. And, you know, trying to trace or trying to track or look after a person that's gone missing from one locality to another when there's arguments over whose jurisdiction it's in and who should be responsible for tracking that case, it's just lost. So I think we just need better communication sharing systems as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very lucky where I work with the local authority I work with. The information sharing is absolutely spotless. It's brilliant, you know, but my view is, you know, when someone's at risk, you know, yes, you've got to, you know, abide by certain protocols. But for me, the risk of that young person and the potential harm that they're going to come to, you know, it kicks out all the barriers for me. And I do think, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done on information sharing. But ultimately, for me, as a live practitioner still involved in safeguarding, ultimately, if I'm passing on information that I know that I'm ultimately going to save a life, then I'm comfortable with it, and I hope that other professionals are too, in that respect. So yeah, you're right. There's a lot of work that needs to be done on that, and hopefully we can start breaking down some of those protocols and some of those barriers to to really force in real change.
Always emphasize the need to have a trauma-informed approach with young people on first presentation or first introductions, because so often these kids have been exposed to so many different types of trauma and they're just behaving differently because of that trauma. And I think the interactions that police have with young people can really impact on the rest of that investigation. You know, if a police officer was to go in and just assume that young person was a perpetrator or, you know, taking out any exploitation, that can completely shut that young person down from speaking about anything. Trauma-informed approach completely.
Yeah, I used to be a student officer trainer. They call them tutor constables. And I used to say to a lot of my officers, you know, you leave a lasting impression. Communication is a real, real big part of the policing job. And it's really important that when you engage with young people, that communication, and any person really, that communication is spot on. So it is a really big thing. And I think sometimes as police officers, we sometimes forget the lasting impressions that contact with the police can have, you know, and it's something that I think a lot of police officers get right. But sometimes, you know, it's like any profession, you know, there's good and there's bad. And there's always room for improvements in my opinion. One question that has just popped into my head, and I'm a massive advocate of this, and me and Paul Wormsley, a guest that I had on the other day, early intervention. Now, I'm a big sort of advocate of this, but I actually think that we need to be getting into kids a lot younger. I sort of feel that when you sort of start dealing with kids, you know, year seven and above, you're sort of losing them a little bit. What are your views on early intervention?
Yeah, I agree. And you know, from the interviews that I did in the youth offending team, all the staff would say by the time that they've reached the youth offending team, it's too late. And it's sad, and it's not meant to write them off at all. It's just that education and that support needs to come way before high school. It needs to come way before the last few years of primary school, I think, as well. And you know, kids on, like you say, they're switched on to this kind of thing. You know, I've given presentations in schools to kids of 10, 11, and they know more than me. Like I said before, they've got phones, they've got social media, I just think we need to take a more drastic approach in educating and trying to help and support families that might be exposed to this kind of exploitation or criminality or behaviour.
Yeah, we started to look at this a little bit when I was in the police, and we started to sort of talk to some of the teachers in the very early years, and they were saying, you know, that if they had a class of, say, I don't know, 20, 25, they would be able to spot the sort of the three or four kids in that class at that age that probably would be the ones that would go on to cause some problems in later life and be the sort of vulnerable kids that would get involved in the sort of stuff that we've been talking about today. So I just think it's the way to go. We just need to look at a plan on how we can implement this kind of work. Your research around COVID-19, I appreciate it hasn't been sort of concluded. You're still working on it with Nottingham University. Can you share anything with us around that research, you know, the sort of things that you're seeing at the moment during COVID?
Yeah, so we've broadly got three main aims of the research, really. So we're looking at the impacts of COVID on the ability of law enforcement to detect and enforce counter-violence activity. We're looking at the impact of frontline agencies to safeguard and support young people involved in counter-violence. And then obviously we're looking at the counter-violence methodology altogether and how that might have changed. So just on the detection and enforcement side, quickly, if we've got time, police have actually reported a lot of success due to COVID. You know, they've had a reallocation of resources because of the closure of the nighttime economy. British Transport Police specifically, you know, those that are operating the rail networks, have had a lot of success, not only in detection, but also safeguarding. So it's become really, really difficult for any young person to be passing through train stations without being stopped and asked questions about why they're travelling, basically. What that's done is force a lot of counter-violence activity onto the roads. Again, that's been quite good for law enforcement because you've got more, you know, you've got number plates, you've got tracing details, you've got driving licences. But I think by July, a lot of the counter-violence activity, or so I'm informed, returned to business as usual. So counter-violence networks have adapted. Some have continued to use some of the new ways of working, particularly face masks, very, very helpful for those involved in crime. We had reports that instead of recruiting or sending young people from major urban cities into these different areas, what they're now doing, the gangs are trying to recruit local children from the local areas to match the demographic of where they're working. So for example, sending a young person from London to a leafy suburb like Cheshire, for example, they might stand out. So the counter-violence orchestrators have started targeting people in those areas to match the demographic. And also if they're picked up by the police, then they can say, well, actually, I am from this area, and it's not raising any suspicion. We had reports that there were minimum transaction costs. So for example, it wasn't possible for Class A drug users to purchase a bag of, or one sort of rock of heroin or crack cocaine. There was a minimum order of about £80 to make it worthwhile for those people to actually make the journey. We had reports of the use of disguises such as Deliveroo. It all makes sense. It, you know, if there is something to be exploited, these individuals will do it. Some of them were dressing up as essential workers, doctors, nurses, builders. Apparently, if you wear a high vis, you're very, very rarely challenged. But what British Transport Police were saying was that basically you'd see a young person pass through the railway, they'd be wearing this builder's outfit, they'd come back 5 hours later, still immaculate, absolutely no sign of them having worked on a building site. So that was another way that they could sort of detect that activity. What else? There's no real change to the cost of drugs, which was surprising, but purity decreased. And we had reports that in some areas there were different adulterants, such as cat litter, you know, being used to bash heroin to make to make up for any lost profits due to sort of increasing price on a wholesale level.
Gosh.
Yeah, there's so much information, and you know it's always changing as well because we're in different phases of lockdown.
And also, you know, like you said, kids now with lockdown, although we're supposed to be on lockdown, I'm still seeing loads of kids out and about and doing stuff. There's more kids out on the streets probably than ever at the moment. It's just a great opportunity for these individuals, particularly what you were just saying about targeting kids within their own areas. The pickings are rich, aren't they, really? There's a great opportunity for, you know, these gangs to sort of really get into some of these kids during this really sensitive period of COVID, isn't there?
There is, and I keep referring back to social media as well, but, you know, young people are on the phones almost 24/7, and Snapchat particularly is one platform that's being used to sort of lure and recruit young people into County Lines, as well as Instagram, I think. We're not really sure. There's a big knowledge gap on how social media is used, but we do know that the main way of recruitment is through social media.
Well, okay, that's interesting. Yeah, there clearly needs to be more work done on that because social media is just so massive, isn't it, for kids? It would be really good, Grace, at some point for you to come back and share that research in a bit more detail with us, really, when you've finished. So if you'd be willing to come back at some point, I'd really, really welcome that.
Yeah.
Because I think it'd be great to get a much better understanding. And, you know, we're going to have a lot of professionals listening to this podcast. So I think it'd be good to share some of those findings with our audience because I think it will help them in their day-to-day roles, really.
Yeah, I'll try and bring on some of my colleagues as well that can offer a different perspective. So,
That'd be brilliant. Tell me more about Black Box and the company that you run, because I know you do some work around expert witness work, don't you? So can you tell us a little bit about that?
I do, yeah. I set Black Box up at the end of 2019. With the focus of providing educational workshops to schools, charities, organisations, and also providing commissioned research. And then halfway through last year, I was contacted by solicitors to write an expert witness report. And from that, that's become the main focus of the business, really. And I was in court last week. I've completed a number of other reports focused on child criminal exploitation and forced labour and County Lines. And I love it. And it's probably the first time that I've actually been able to see a direct impact of the work that I do, actually helping children and young people. And don't get me wrong, there are children and young people that get involved in County Lines off their own back and obviously enjoy it and want to be involved, but for those that are victims and have been subjected to violence and trauma, I am really happy that I can actually help.
A bit of a controversial question, but if, say, for example, you were asked to do that work and you were clear in your mind that that individual was kind of enjoying it, they were kind of very much involved in it, what would your views be on that in terms of supporting that?
I would have to make that clear, basically. It's everything that I would put in a report is based on the evidence that I'm provided with. And if there is no evidence of exploitation, and by that I mean evidence of duress, evidence that they've been subjected to violence, threats, you know, they may have had their homes targeted, windows smashed. If there's none of that, I can't write in that report that I think there's been exploitation. It's just based on the evidence.
Yeah, I totally get that. I think one of the things that, you know, we're both in agreement with, and in terms of young people, is that we don't want to write young people off at all, and we want to try and sort of look at some of these issues in a bit more depth, which is obviously the great work that you're doing with the university and other work that you're doing across the UK, and really try and look at how we as a collective community safety sort of partnership can really sort of get into some of these young people. And my view is, you know, if we save one or two lives, then we're doing a fantastic job, and I'm sure we can achieve that. So it's just been really good to sort of hear your views and look at sort of some of the ideas. I know a lot of the stuff we've talked about today is not going to be a simple solution and 5-minute job, but I think we've got to have hope, haven't we, in terms of what we can achieve. Otherwise, we might as well all just pack up and go home.
Yeah, hope and patience as well, because it's not going to happen overnight. And you,
no, it's not.
You know, you can work tirelessly with a child, but only when they're ready, or only when the dynamic is right and they've had enough education will they begin to make changes. So it's just about perseverance and constantly providing that safety net for that young person.
Oh, that's brilliant, and it's really good to hear. And I can certainly echo that from some of my experiences on the ground as well, that if you put the right time and effort into young people, then you can make a difference. And I wholeheartedly believe that. Grace, this has been a fantastic interview. I've really enjoyed every minute of it. And you've given some fantastic insights into county lines and child criminal exploitation. And I'm sure the audience have got an awful lot from it. Just before we sort of wrap up, is there any question that I haven't asked you that you would have liked me to have asked you today?
I don't think so. I could probably talk for another few hours, so I'm going to leave that for the second podcast that I do in a few months when we finish the research project.
Brilliant. That's fine. That's no problem at all. I appreciate your honesty. So thank you so much, Grace, for coming on. It's been brilliant. I've really enjoyed it. Just a message out to the audience really now, in terms of, if you like what you hear today, please rate and subscribe to the Community Safety Podcast. We want to really get our mission across to as many people as possible. So if you like what you're hearing today, please tell people, please tell your friends, please get them to come and listen to this podcast. We really do appreciate you listening in, and also, we're really interested in your feedback as well. So thank you very much. And we will be back very shortly with another episode of the Community Safety Podcast. Thank you for listening. That was a really interesting interview with Dr. Grace Robinson around the subject of county lines, the exploitation of young people into the drugs trade. I think it was really important that we got the message across, how it all works, how young people are exploited into the drugs trade, how they're treated. And we also looked at, you know, other issues around the links to cannabis use. I think sometimes that the cannabis use in this country is played down. I think it's a really serious subject, and I think it really needs to be explored further. And I just think that we sort of explored a couple of ways that we could possibly help with this situation. It's really important that we spread as much awareness about county lines as we can across professionals, the wider community, so they can start to identify if they feel that something's wrong, and that they report it in, you know, in the correct way. So can't thank Grace enough for her time today. It was just a brilliant sort of 40-45 minutes. Young people are so important, and I feel that the podcast is going to help us as a collective community to work harder with young people, look at the right channels on how we can sort of get them back on the straight and narrow if they have gone down the wrong path. And we can do it all together if we change our views. As I said earlier when I introduced this podcast, if we all leave our egos at the door, then I'm sure we can achieve great things. Please like, rate and subscribe to the Community Safety Podcast. We really want to get our mission across to as many people as possible. Please don't just listen to this podcast. We really genuinely want you to be involved. Spread the word, tell friends. Let's all have a listen, and let's all help change communities for the better in the 21st century. You can also reach the Community Safety Podcast on our website, which is www.thecommunitysafetypodcast.co.uk. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. We really do appreciate your support. And just a final mention to our sponsors, St. Ives Chambers Birmingham, RHE Global, and Me Learning. Without your help and support, this podcast just wouldn't have become a reality. So I can't thank you all enough for your ongoing support with this project.
You've been listening to the Community Safety Podcast. Community Safety Podcast. With thanks for support from St. Ives Chambers, RHE Global, and Me Learning. Join us again next time to help us explore how we can transform our communities in the 21st century. On the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.